Hey everybody, it's Writers in the Round. My guests, Casey Charland and Mike Cabernas, are both part of Chattercon, which is celebrating its 45th year. Is that right, Casey? 45th this year?
Yes, sir.
So you guys are closing in on 50, huh? I imagine you're going to have a blowout for 50.
Oh, definitely.
How long have you been involved with it?
Probably 30 years.
Have you really? 30 years?
Yeah, I started very young.
This year they have you listed as a member at large. What does that mean?
I actually get a year to take a break. Which means also means I have to do everything.
Yeah, that's what I interpreted it as meaning. Yeah, that you're open for anybody to call on you to help with them with whatever aspect of it. Huh?
And I usually do that anyway. And we have different events on Friday night. We have a big opening celebration, opening ceremonies, and a kind of a meet and greet. So we like to provide things for people there, and all the authors and artists and guests will come and can actually talk to them and meet them in person. And of course, the rest of the board of directors is there, so we get to meet the people and say, you know, welcome to the convention.
So that's pretty informal, I guess.
That's pretty informal. We also have a con suite, which is food and beverages all weekend long. We'll be open 24/7. I think it closes down like 1 hour in the early mornings to clean up and get that taken care of. But that's provided for our guests and no charge, or with the membership. There's also panels and discussions that people go to at the art show. We're going to do a masquerade on Saturday night, so that should be fun. A costume contest, a masquerade.
So what is your role in all that, especially as an at-large member? Have you been involved in programming this year and that kind of thing?
I still do a little bit of publicity. I still do some of the local stuff. I started out as games director, so I still help out the gaming department, and that's probably what I'll be doing mostly this year at Chattercon, is helping out in the gaming department. They do tabletop games, computer games, role-playing games, live-action games, any kind of game you want.
That's what I was thinking when you said that. When you start talking about games at Chattercon, that's very broad.
It is.
Everything from really old school, where you sit down, I'm assuming, at a table with a board game,
mm-hmm.
to something that's on video or digital, and then in person, right? You have people who like role-play games.
Exactly. We do have a large library of board games, some of them European, and they're basically there. Anybody that wants to play can come and pick up a deck of cards and play that game, or pick up a set of dice and roll those. There's all kinds of different games. So there's things that if you've never done a role-playing game before, you can pick it up and just play with the cards. It tells you exactly what to do in your moves. If you're an experienced role player, there's lots of tournaments that are designed for higher level. They'll pick up Friday afternoon and go all the way to Sunday morning.
What time's it start?
Well, opening ceremonies is at 7 on Friday, but the registration opens at 3.
And my impression is that that's 3 o'clock Friday to whatever time Sunday. It never stops at any point between those two times.
Nope. We do kind of tote it down in the wee hours, but pretty much it starts Friday afternoon and goes all, there's something going on all the way till Sunday afternoon when we do closing ceremonies.
Do you guys, in effect, take over the hotel?
Oh, yeah. I'm pleased to say we're at the DoubleTree Inn, mm-hmm. which we've just moved to this year. So it's a new space for us and the new hotel staff for us. So it's going to be interesting to see how it goes this year. But we've been doing this a long time, so we kind of know what we're doing. And the hotel staff, they've moved with us from the Reed House to the Tutu. Some of them have known us for years. So I think it's going to be a really good convention.
Well, I can see how staff with whom you've worked before would be very helpful, because I imagine they have a role something similar to camp counselors a lot of the time. Huh?
Have to clean up after us. We do a pretty good job of that ourselves, though.
How long have you been involved with it, Mike?
Well, I'm very much new to the whole scene, obviously, since I only moved here recently. I attended last year. I didn't do anything on the organizational side or anything, but I participated in numerous panels, and I represented the Chattanooga Writers Guild with a table there, and I promoted the guild and tried to get people interested in what we do. So I'm going to be doing much the same thing this year, which is basically just enjoying the con. I've got a panel to participate in, which I'm going to be having fun with, I hope. And hopefully the audience will too. And then, of course, I will be handing out information flyers and maybe trying to sell the odd book or two from our members of the guild.
Are you drawn to role-playing games at all?
I'm so tempted to answer that in a particular fashion, but I restrain myself. No, generally not. I do like fantasy and sci-fi, and I relish movies and books and things. I grew up on Doctor Who, the old school Doctor Who as well, the one with the shaky sets and when the doors closed.
What do you think of Jodie? Do you like Jodie as Doctor
Who?
I don't mind her,
although I think the writing has become very too much woke, in my opinion. But, I mean, the fact that it's a female doctor is, it's not a bad thing. I don't find that
She's such a great actor, too.
Well, she is. She is, yeah. She's very good in various roles. I've seen her in different things.
Yes, yeah. I think so too.
And I actually like her better than Capaldi. I felt Capaldi might have been the wrong choice for him, for the Doctor, personally. Still, old school sci-fi and fantasy I'm very much on board with, but I never got into the whole dress-up thing. Although
You would think he'd be a natural for it.
Yeah, but the only role that I could take is Hagrid. And we all know it. You know, that's the only costume that is ever going to go on.
You'd make a great Hagrid, though.
That or Hodor.
Let me share just a piece of your bio. Let me introduce you again to Mike Abernus. As you can tell from Mike's accent, he is... You grew up in the UK, I think, didn't you?
That's true.
They describe you as Anglo-American.
Right.
But that really could be hyphenated as Anglo-American Norwegian after having spent 20 years
there. Yeah, I typically tell people that I'm half American, half English, and half Norwegian.
Yeah.
And if that's one half too many, I say there's plenty more for me to, you know. There's room enough for everyone.
To spend two decades in a country is to become pretty immersed in the culture.
Very much so. I mean, it's not to say that I understand everything, every nuance, by any means, because I don't. But
you
pretty much have to grow up there as a child, I think, for that to happen. Well, I learned the language, I lived with the Norwegians, I worked with them, and I skied with them. And I even saunered with them, which is, of course, a unique experience, because there, you have to be willing to go from the hot to the cold, in a very real sense. They like to jump out into the snow and, well, they roll in the snow after the sauna.
Do they really?
Yeah, they really do.
Well, I mean, your body comes vividly alive, I think.
It's refreshing,
that.
Let's put it
all
that way.
All the pores are wide open.
Something's open, that's for sure.
So, as you probably have gathered, Mike, as it says in his bio, has always been an adventurer. He's travelled extensively in Europe by motorcycle, by train, and felucca, which I've just learned is a type of sailboat, that mostly in Egypt and the Northeast. He's also travelled by car and RV in the United States. He's lived on a kibbutz and a moshav in the Golan Heights, a small caravan in East Berlin just after the wall came down. And for several years, as Mike says, his favourite part of his life, he was living aboard a sailboat with his family in Annapolis in Maryland. So given all that, and the fact that you studied history, English literature, and language, and interestingly, Old English and Old Norse.
Yeah, I've always been fascinated with the Viking culture, you know. Big, hairy men. I mean, there's something there that draws me. I don't know what it is. And I'm, you know, I guess I feel an affinity somehow. So I've been fascinated with their culture from the Anglo-Saxon period forward. And I've studied, well, for decades, 40 years I've been studying that side of history. So I became an early medievalist, you could say.
But you don't write about that.
I actually have.
Oh, have you?
Yes, I've got a couple of short stories that have been published in anthologies that touch upon Norse mythology in particular. I did a twist on Odin. I felt that it was interesting that Odin, of course, has long fallen out of favor as a god of choice, even among Scandinavians. But I thought to myself, what if he was just biding his time? And how would that work? And what would it require? And I wrote a book, or rather a couple of short stories. There's actually a third one pending. So it's a trilogy of stories. And one of them is The Gospel of Odin. And it's upon the discovery of The Gospel of Odin that the old faith will renew. And so that's been a sort of not an obsession, but a fascination for me. I very much enjoy researching them and, of course, criticizing TV shows that get it wrong. That's one of my favorite pastimes. I just love that.
So all of this, you know, obviously you have a very rich imagination. You've written in a number of books, according to your bios again, metaphysical fantasy, historical fiction.
Yeah, I jump genres because there's so much that fascinates me and interests me, and I don't see any reason to sort of focus on any one thing.
And they all have sampling in common that they're somewhat imaginative, right? That you have to conjure a world in your imagination in order to be able to write.
Well, I don't create worlds. I use the real world as the basis all the time. So the idea basically is for me just to take an ordinary setting, an ordinary person, and then make something bizarre and fascinating happen to them. And I like that approach. And that's basically Stephen King's approach as well. I basically ripped him off from that.
Well, it wasn't original to him either.
Well, let's be fair, it wasn't, though. I mean, that's true. There's nothing new under the sun. So.
No, I don't think so. And there's nothing in that that takes away from anything you've done, because I think, as always, you know, if you want to go back to the blues, which is one easy way for me to express that idea, that it's not the words you use, it's the context you put them in. So you can use the same words or the same concepts, but come up with a fresh twist on it. That's what people are always looking for in a good blues song from Time Eternal. And I think that's probably true of writers too, right?
I think that's a very good point, actually. If you think about it, the blues scale is the simplest of scales, mm-hmm, of all of them. And yet it's the most expressive. And that's down to the individual's character and personality and obviously ability. And when you combine these things and you play well, then, you know, the same note can be played by a dozen different people and it will sound different.
That's so true, isn't it?
Yeah.
On top of which, the best bluesmen were natural storytellers.
Yeah, well, definitely true.
And they sketched a world for you.
I've always been very fond of B.B. King, I must admit. I consider him to be perhaps the master of vibrato. There's nobody better. And the reason I know this is because he could pretty much bend and play a note with any finger of his left hand. And any guitarist out there knows you favor one or two. You can't use them all.
That he could use all four fingers and a thumb. Huh?
And basically, no, I don't mean to say you don't use your finger, but he could bend a note and hold it and sustain it and vibrato it to the same level and same strength and same degree across all the digits. It didn't matter if it was his third or his first finger or his second or anything.
Yeah, I didn't realize that. That's amazing.
Yeah, I've seen him do that, and it's quite astonishing. I can't do that, and I played guitar for 40 years. So I know that's a trick. That's a thing that he trained hard to do. And, well, that's, of course, the same in any passion that you have. You have to really dedicate yourself to it. I was a dilettante with the guitar, but not with the writing.
So I'm still curious as to why, other than your Hagrid excuse, why it is that you're not drawn to role-playing games?
Oh, I don't know. I suppose I'm
yeah, you seem
inhibited.
To be a natural.
I'm inhibited. I'm a bizarre character. I'm an inhibited exhibitionist. So I don't know which way to turn, really.
What was your experience at Chattercon?
I loved it. I thought it was wonderful fun.
It's interesting to talk to somebody for whom this is all new, and,
yeah,
and this is essentially, this will be your second year.
And in point of fact, that was my only experience of a con at all. I hadn't ever been to one before.
What did you expect?
I suppose, you know, I've seen things like from Japan where they come in giant robot suits, and there was less of that than I was thinking there might be. But there were plenty of people walking around in costumes and stuff, and there were lots of shows and events and things. But the one aspect that I think that I totally didn't expect, as Casey was talking about earlier, was the art gallery. It's a staggering level of creativity that's on display there. And across the spectrum in terms of talent, from very much amateurs to extraordinary professional works of art. And then there was other things like the dealer's room. You can go there and you can buy stuff. Things. Now, I mean, we talked earlier about minimalism and how things weigh you down, but honestly, who doesn't need a TARDIS teapot? I mean, really?
Good question.
I think you'd do wonderfully in a steampunk costume.
Yeah, I think I could go with that, actually. Yeah.
And you don't have to be a role player. You can just go as a costume and look the gentleman and...
I something about the monocle.
Yeah.
I'll
either
go
a monocle or goggles.
I'll go
one.
As Mr. Peanut.
How do you present this to the hotel when you try to enlist a hotel in order as a place to stage it? Because I get the impression increasingly, especially listening to Mike, that you guys create your own little world within the world.
We do, and we were very lucky to have the tutu for 9 years, I believe. And as you know, the tutu is kind of its own compound, so once you got there, you didn't have to leave the entire weekend. But we do have the electric shuttles, and people travel all over downtown in costume, usually, like to City Cafe or to, you know, different Big River, different places. Terminal was very busy the weekend we were there because it's right next to the tutu. The hotel is usually very happy when we come because it's in January where they're not necessarily selling out, and we'll sell out the hotel. And if we can sell out the hotel, they're pretty happy.
So, how many people do you typically draw to the conventions?
The largest one we ever had was at the Reed House, and it topped about 1,500. So it's kind of gone back, peeled back since then, because there are more conventions in town now that people go to and for different things. So the last few years, we've been hovering right around 800. So, you know, there's
that's a lot of people.
A good group of people.
I think you're right on the money when you say it's like its own world. I've always thought it was a little bit like Vegas. When you go to a casino in Vegas and you walk in, you don't really know if it's day or night outside after a while. You just get sort of absorbed and consumed by what's happening around you, all the flashing lights and the colors and the noises. And it's exactly the same thing at the con. Unless you actually go outside, you'll never know what time of day or night it is.
Really?
There's so much happening all the time.
Well, tell me about it. So you did you get there Friday afternoon?
Yes, I actually went home there every night. If you're actually staying in the hotel, then, of course, you don't need to leave the building. But I was living nearby, so it's sort of fruitless and pointless to actually fork out whatever it costs to go for a room, and I didn't. So I would leave. But when I was there, for whatever length of time it was fully absorbing, and I didn't even think about what was going on in the outside world. And I would check out the time. I'd be surprised to discover it was like 2 a.m. or something like this. And I thought, oh, good Lord. I actually.
What were you doing?
Oh, just enjoying the entire thing. There were so many events. There were parties. There were people to talk to. An endless number of people to talk to, and so many funny characters, and so many great costumes, and yeah, it was just an endlessly entertaining big party. I just think of it, in fact, as one party, not multiple. Really, I think that's the way to think of it because there were so many things happening. You could separate them all. You can go to the game room and you can go to the, I don't know, whatever, some other place, you know. But for me, it was all just a big one. I liked it. Once you walked into the door, you were in the world. You know, you'd moved into that fantasy world at that point. So I love that part of it, actually.
And the opportunity to talk to other people who do what you do.
That's true as well. There were plenty of writers on suite. And in fact, I'm hoping to meet one of them that I met last year because I took his book and didn't pay him a penny for it. I said, I'll just pop to the ATM and I forgot. So I still owe him $20. So if he's there, I'll find him.
We do have a lot of also attendings. Stephanie Osborne, Alan Lewis, Amanda Makepeace. She's an artist. There's a list on the website. www.chatacon.org.
And then there's a section for program information for the dealer's room that you mentioned, the con suite, gaming, art show. Each one of them is in effect a separate website.
Well, it's got a separate page.
Yeah. So it's as Mike said, it's like a multifaceted event going on.
Well, it definitely
constantly
is.
for more than 48 hours.
We began as Chattanooga science fiction fans. And now we've rechartered and we've changed our name to Chattanooga Speculative Fiction Fans Incorporated. And that's our nonprofit mother company, which I'm also a member of the board of directors of. That's the entity that actually decides where the money raised goes. So we donate to the Kid Club, the Discovery Center, Boys and Girls Club. We've donated to them when the library was blown up and was blown over in Ringgold, we donated money to them. So we pick charities each year and donate money to them if we make a profit. Some years we don't make a profit, but, you know, we still keep going on.
Well, my understanding is that the first year it was staged, it lost money. But within 3 years, they had made enough money to pay back the original organizer the money that he lost The first time he staged it.
The first year was pretty small. I think there was about 25 people.
And nobody knew what to expect. And this was 1976.
Right.
So you've been doing this for a long time. So you've reached the point now where not only are you covering your expenses, but you have money left over. That's quite something. Because I imagine it costs a lot of money to stage something like this, doesn't it?
It does. But, you know, if people pay their memberships and we provide food and beverage and all this entertainment and a lot of our guests, since we're a nonprofit, we don't pay for our guests to attend. So none of our guests are actually paid. We, of course, pay to get them here and pay for their stay and pretty show them a pretty good time while they're here. But they never make money from us. So, again, it's part of being a nonprofit, part of giving back. And that is pretty much why we try to focus on the literacy and literature. So the things we did for the Boys and Girls Club is we bought them Nooks and provided books for them on the Nooks. And like I said, helping the libraries, helping the Discovery, the Challenger Station, we've supported them for years. So reaching out and giving back to the community, that's what Sphinx is all about. So, and it's now speculative fiction, which means it isn't just science fiction and fantasy. You know, we've got the horror, we've got steampunk, we've got alternate histories. There's all kinds of little nuances that are not just the one thing. We've got graphic novels now, which didn't used to be really considered, you know, a book. But graphic novels are really big right now. Look at Neil Gaiman. So in the TV series and things like that, you know, we don't focus on those. We did have Timothy Zahn, who writes Star Wars books. And,
oh, gosh, that's right.
Yeah, so we had a kind of a Star Wars focus last year, but it was because of the books, not because of the movies. And, in fact, one year Peter Mayhew came, Chewbacca came. He lived in Texas at the time, and he called us and said, I see Timothy Zahn's coming to be at your convention. Could I come be there, too? And we're like, sure, because he came and he signed autographs, and you know it was great. I got to be Chewbacca.
I put my foot in it with Timothy last year, actually.
Oh, did you?
I said something really dumb to him.
Well, we won't let you repeat it.
It was very funny and embarrassing. No, I'd like to tell the story if you'll indulge me. I'm not a big fan of the Star Wars franchise. I love the originals, but I really got turned off by a lot of the later movies, like many people did. Although I kind of come back to the fold now, I'm starting to enjoy them again. But I've never read Timothy's books, so I really didn't know too much about him as a writer. And I popped along to the writer's room or the dealer's room, whatever, and I saw him there. And I said, oh, well, I'll go buy one of his books. And I thought he looked a little bit like, who's the gentleman that plays Picard in Star Trek? What's his
Patrick
name?
Patrick Stewart.
Patrick Stewart. So I thought he looked a little bit like Patrick Stewart.
Great voice.
And I said to him, so is your popularity due to your resemblance to Jean-Luc Picard? Is that why you've got so many fans, I said? And he said, no, that's Star Trek. I do Star Wars. And I thought, okay.
Open shot mouth, you down, didn't he?
Insert foot.
I think that's more common than you want to think.
Yeah, well, I feel a bit embarrassed by that because at least as a science fiction writer, I should be aware of the difference. But of course I am.
Yes, of course.
I just wasn't aware of the difference relating to him, but still.
What I'm getting is that it really started as a kind of literary convention.
Yes.
That you were readers first.
Definitely.
And that was what drew you together.
That was the core value of it, was literature. And in the early days, we didn't have the internet. We didn't have the networking we have now. And to be able to invite your favorite author to come and spend the weekend and just be able to sit at a table and you know, play guitar. I've sat on the floor with Spider Robinson playing guitar and singing Beatles songs. It was awesome. Just to have that kind of one-on-one ship with people and even getting together with like-minded people, because at some point you realize the people at the convention are really the people that get you. They're your tribe. They're the people that know how you feel. And they understand how different we are than a lot of the other people in the world. So, yeah, it's definitely focused on literature, but also, you know, there's other aspects of it. I mean, we have to admit that the movies are huge. We have to admit those Tolkien movies, Lord of the Rings trilogy, those were huge, and they're epic, and they're beautiful. And, you know, I'm glad to say I've read the books first because it made the story a little more intimate to me, and I understood it a little bit more. So I think most of the really great science fiction movies or fantasy movies are based on novels, even where we've Game of Thrones. You know, it's based on a series of novels. Mm. So it's just everything kind of comes in full circle. If it's a really good book, someone's going to pick it up and make a movie. So, and that's great because that just gives us more to do, more to watch, more to see. And it's just an extra part of, you know, the science fiction fantasy world.
I think it's interesting how that's actually becoming more mainstream now. There was a time when to be a sci-fi fan meant nerd. Mm-hmm. You were a nerd. Mm-hmm. And that was almost a mark of shame, you know. But today, who isn't a fan of Marvel? I can't imagine that many people would actually say they didn't enjoy Iron Man or Wonder Woman. My goodness, those are great movies. So the fantasy genre is now mainstream in a very real sense. And I think that's just a wonderful thing.
No, I think Marvel Universe and DC also, those movies bring in more mainstream. It's got a huge following. Now, I'm not saying people are going to go watch the movie and, you know, go out and read all the comic books and, you know, find books and about the superheroes, because I don't think there are many out there. But same concept, though. I mean, you kind of get in that same fantasy sense of mind. It's a different world. So you're kind of maybe thinking, what else is out there? What else can I find?
Well, that's a good point. And point of fact, then, when you discover something for the first time, let's say you start getting into one of those shows, you find original Star Trek. You knew it was always there, but you never watched it. Then you become a fan, and then you get to buy some cool posters or some, you know, like these replica ray guns or whatever they have that you can buy and things like that. That's kind of cool and fun. Same with Doctor Who. I mentioned earlier my TARDIS teapot. That's not a joke. I want one. So I'm hoping somebody has one this year. And if not, well, I'll find something that'll satisfy that need for a little blue box in my home.
Well, that's always the thing with being a fan, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's so easily mocked, but it's for fans, it's fun. And if you don't get that, then you don't get what it is to be a fan. To be honest with you, was not a fan at all of the original Star Trek. My brother loved it and watched it all the time, and I thought it was, I just didn't think it was very well acted or very well written. But
both things are true, frankly, but nonetheless, it was still highly entertaining.
Jean-Luc Picard, to me, was a revelation, and that whole series in which he was the captain, I just thought it was amazing. It was beautifully written. It was the production values were so high. I loved it.
But, you know, they're doing a new series called Picard.
Oh, they are?
They're bringing him back.
With Patrick Stewart. Yeah. I don't know how it was for you, Mike, but growing up, I loved American comic books. They were hard to find. And
no, for me, it wasn't an option. I didn't have that ability to buy them.
They kind of pop up at random for us, you know. It wasn't, I can only imagine what it must have been like to go to the store every week and get the next installment of the story and be able I never had that option. But
comics for me began and more or less ended with the original Star Wars comics that came out in 77. And I bought them. I bought the original comics. There was about a dozen that told the story of episode 4. And I bought those and I've preserved those for, well, since I was 13 years old until only a few years ago when I gave them to my nephew. And he'd become a Star Wars fan only recently, and he wasn't really aware of the merchandise or the old comics or any of that stuff. So when I sent them to him, he was in England, and I sent them to him, and he got a box, and it arrived. He was floored with the colors, the artwork, the storyline. Everything was there, and of course, it also includes additional stories, which are great as well. I don't pretend otherwise. I'm sure some of my ideas may come from those old comics. I feel that there is something great in that, and I regret so much giving them to him. But at least he likes them.
Yeah, so he's getting a big boot out of it.
Yeah,
they were just so different from the comics that we had, which, you know, despite my mother's best efforts, I read them all the time.
Was it Beezer? Them, you know? Beezer was the
Beezer. There was Adventure and. I don't know, Boys World. There's a bunch of them.
Who was Nasher? There was Nasher and somebody, I remember.
We had basically two styles of comic, Casey. There are either comics that were truly comic, you know, with very broadly drawn characters and absurd plots, or there were these, you know, hero comics.
There was Flash,
players,
there
was
Dick
Tracy. Yeah. Sword-waving heroes, that kind of thing, you know.
No superheroes? Spider-Man? Batman.
No, there really wasn't.
That's the interesting thing. That was what was completely different about English comics, that they were very much the guy next door could be a character in the comic.
Hmm.
You know, there were people, if you didn't know them, there were people you wish you did, you know, because they're very appealing personalities and...
Dennis the Menace.
Yeah, Dennis the Menace.
Yeah.
Is
they were awful.
The antithesis, yeah.
They had no style. That, you know, the DC and the Marvel, these things were revelations, really are. And they still are. They're phenomenal artwork. I mean, I would happily hang a print from an original DC comic if it was hand-drawn by the... I mean, who wouldn't?
Oh, yeah, no doubt.
I'd be thrilled to own something like that.
And the word is that those two guys that wrote the original Superman comics, two nerdy little guys, right,
yeah,
who were fantasizing about being the guy that kicks the sand in bullies' faces and all
right.
that. What drew you to writing fantasy fiction?
It's always been an interest for me, the fantasy world. I've enjoyed fantasy writers for many years and science fiction. And I just wanted to read books that I wanted to read. I wanted to write books, rather, that I wanted to read.
Mm.
So I tried to pen something that would have entertained me. And that's what my goal was. So that's the express purpose of what I do. It's really just intended to be an audience of one. And if anybody else likes it, all the better.
But while we're calling it fantasy, you said that it's grounded in the real world.
It's entirely true, yeah. It's called metaphysical fantasy, which is a bit of a subgenre, in the sense that I don't create worlds with things that don't exist. I only write about things that people generally do believe exist. And whether or not you agree with them or not, but somebody here on the planet today does, and by which I mean at least 1.5 billion people believe in what I wrote about in my first series. The jinn. For example, in the Quran, there are three orders of life specified: man, jinn, and angel. And that's the premise of my book series, The Guardian. It's literally exploring the possibility that mankind isn't the only intelligent order of life, even on this planet, that there are other levels of intelligence, just simply multidimensional.
What's a jinn? That's J-I-N, right?
D-J-I-N-N, I spell it. But otherwise, yes, that's commonly misconstrued as being a genie. But that's actually not an appropriate term.
That sounds like that's a kind of anglicized version of gin.
It's actually a mistranslation. Some French guy saw the word gin and thought it sounded like the old Latin genius, which was a sort of inspirational thing that lived within all, and he just called it a genie, and it somehow stuck. But the reality is the real gin, he can be a mischievous, he can be a helpful, he can be an evil character. And if you look at Arabic folklore, they're full of it. Every time there's a sandstorm and there's a twister in the desert, you know, you ward off the evil eye, because that could be an ifrit. That might be a jinn. So I took the idea and I ran with it. I had the idea that maybe the jinn could be an inquisitive fellow. He could be somebody that just wants to know us the way we would want to know them. And he wants to live with us. The problem is he doesn't have a body. He just needs to have some kind of connection with somebody. So, yeah, I won't go more into detail.
That's interesting because there's also that idea of the trickster god.
Yes.
Right?
True,
and,
yes.
And that's Haitian, I think, isn't it? Because it came into Mississippi.
You find that in
voodoo?
Lots of cultures. Even the Vikings had their trickster god with Loki, for example. And the Native Americans had a trickster god with Coyote, I think it was.
Yes, I think you're right. Yeah.
So, you know, the trickster god concept is one of those human things that we have constantly reinvented or rediscovered or re-experienced.
What do you think that's about? Is that a way of explaining the perversions of our existence?
Well, you know, I haven't gone into that depth. I think we have to go back to some very solid anthropology studies or something to get an understanding of that. But I think, you know, humans share experiences and they interpret them in much the same way, no matter who you are, no matter where you are. we're not really all that different from each other.
No, I don't think we're very different at all.
No, I mean,
and you're pretty well placed to comment on that. Experience a number of different cultures firsthand.
No matter where I go in the world, you see the same things. People want the same things. People act in the same way. They want to look after their family. They want to be successful. They want to do well by, you know, their cultural standards and so on. It's the same no matter whether they're going to be pygmies in the rainforest or, I presume, Aztecs.
There are unique qualities about given cultures too, aren't there? What did you find most interesting or perhaps surprising about living in Norway?
I never really gave that any thought. Surprising or interesting? Let's see. Well, they're extraordinarily out. How to say this? They are physically out there. They will go out in sub-zero temperatures that you would imagine would challenge a scientific expedition to the Arctic, and you'll see little old ladies out there with just their little woolly hats and gloves and just having the best time. They don't concern themselves with the cold at all. I mean, this, of course, will be in Fahrenheit, minus 40 Fahrenheit. That's not unfeasible temperatures there. But perhaps they wouldn't ski in those temperatures. But certainly, I don't know how to do Fahrenheit on this conversion, so minus 15 centigrade. I've skied in that frequently. I think as you get sub-zero, the difference between Fahrenheit and centigrade starts dropping away.
Oh, that's interesting.
I'm not 100%, because honestly, the conversion ratio or the conversion thing, I can never do it. I cannot convert Fahrenheit to Celsius and back. I'm good with miles and kilometers and inches and centimeters, but Fahrenheit and centigrade has me flummoxed.
Yes, you had to learn a metric scale. You didn't have any choice about that, right?
That's true. Although that wasn't terribly hard. It's more logical anyway.
It's all tens.
Yeah, it's all tens.
So, what were you doing in Norway?
I designed environmental information systems for national governments in various parts of the world. So I worked on a lot of research things. I did a lot of stuff with the EU. So I had projects in various countries.
To do what exactly?
Well, yeah, mostly environmental research, so a lot of air quality, which is what we were essentially doing, but it would touch on to other aspects of the environment, so very often water, soil, and air. So you can get a project that combines various elements of these things, and then, you know, you do a study. You look at eutrophication rates and the impact on something or whatever. And so scientists would need support. They would need data collected. They would need it stored, transported, parsed, displayed, and, you know, lots of tricks with data, basically. So it was basically data management, I suppose you could say.
Well, you're a researcher, aren't you?
No, I was more on the computer side of things, although I did like to dabble in the other aspects and stuff. And I helped them anyway. I mean, I was a writer, so, of course, I helped on a lot of papers. I have over 60 scientific publications to my name, largely as a result of collaboration with actual scientists.
But you have these sort of dual tracks in your life, don't you? Because you are a researcher as a writer.
That's true.
And you know, as we said before, you know, your interest in Old Norse mythology.
Oh, yeah. Well, yeah. I mean, I've always been fascinated with history and reading and so on. So from that perspective, that's true. But I never did any genuine research. I didn't go off to the library in Copenhagen and dig out some ancient old Viking manuscript that no one's ever looked at before and decipher it. That would be real genuine research on that scale. So I was just, you know, standing on the shoulders of those that went before on that level. But when I was working in Norway, I was working with people that were doing something genuinely new and unique and different. And we knew all sorts of things that were very interesting. For example, when the Fukushima nuclear power plant had a little upset, we knew they were lying about the radiation levels. We knew before anybody else in the world knew. And one of our guys published a paper that really embarrassed the Japanese dramatically and terribly and forced them to confess that things were, in fact, much worse than they had claimed. So there were opportunities to be at the cutting edge of science, and that was kind of fun.
It's often observed that people who travel often travel looking to find what they left behind.
I often consider that, yeah. There's, you know, people can be unhappy where they are, and they think that if they go somewhere different, they'll find their happiness there. And it's that old bluebird thing, isn't it? It was there all along, right? And I think that's true. You know, you've got to be happy with yourself, and you've got to be happy with who you are, and then it doesn't matter where you are. So taking yourself away from place A and going to place B won't fix anything if you're broken. You need to fix yourself before...
Right, because you just take the broken parts along with you.
Totally.
But you've managed to live, and I assume, you know, adjust and be happy in a range of different situations.
I totally believe I could actually adjust to living in any culture anywhere.
How do you do that?
Within reason. Being interested, just simply being open to the experience and trying to understand the people and throw yourself into it. Learn the language. And then you'll
become... How long did it take you to learn Norwegian?
Well, it's a lifelong thing, isn't it? I don't suppose I'm finished yet. I actually...
But you're pretty fluent in it? You can understand it and speak it?
Yeah, mer eller mindre. Jeg ikke helt flytende, men jeg kan greie nok for min selv, egentlig. If there are any Norwegians listening, I do apologize.
I love the sound of it, but I can't imagine trying to learn how to speak. It's because it's almost like singing. It's a different cadence.
Well, I suppose I might have overemphasized it a bit for dramatic effect.
But I've watched Norwegian programs, and people do speak that way.
That's true, I'm sure. And it can be much more pronounced, actually. If you go to Sweden, boy, it's genuinely Swedish chef stuff over there in some parts. Really, hurdy, hurdy, hurdy. But I actually maintain the language by speaking with my my dear ex-wife. We speak Norwegian very often together just to keep it up. I don't know any other Norwegians locally, so she's the only one that knows it. And my daughter, who was fluent, has forgotten it, sadly.
Well, if you don't keep using it, right?
Well, yeah, but even so, after just a few short years, she doesn't remember anything and she can't understand anything. I, as an adult, seem to have better long-term memory retention, so it suggests to me that children have good short-term learning capabilities, but it's very short-term memory. If it's not reinforced constantly, it disappears quickly. And that appears to be true because she forgot how to speak Norwegian within 6 months.
Well, it strikes me that for her that was a survival mechanism to learn how to make herself understood. But for you, it was a deeper fascination than simply survival.
Well, but she already knew English. Mm-hmm. So it wasn't like she had to sort of dump one language to learn another.
No, but in order to communicate with her peers, she had to at least speak some Norwegian.
She was very good in Norwegian when she was there.
Right.
It's just after she came here and she lived here for a short time.
She doesn't need it anymore.
No, that's true. That's true. Mm-hmm. And, well, you know, now she's learning Russian instead, so it's...
Oh, really?
Yeah. Yeah, it's all good. So whenever I speak to her in Norwegian, she replies in Russian, which is really frustrating for me because I hardly speak any. So...
So you've travelled literally, and you've also travelled widely in your imagination. Do you see a correlation between the two?
I suppose there could be. I think it's entirely possible to let your imagination roam free without ever leaving your home.
It is. Emily Dickinson proved that.
Right, I suppose that's true, yes. I genuinely draw on a lot of experiences that I've had in the real world. I've written about things that people think I've created and made up, but they're real. They happened. And maybe I put them in situations that are a little bit fantastical, but the events were based on real things. And sometimes, reality is stranger than fiction. It can be.
Most of the time, I think that's probably true. Things happen all the time, don't they, that you couldn't possibly have imagined would ever occur.
I could tell you some stories that would curl your toes.
Well, I believe you could. Do you mostly travel in your imagination, Casey?
I've not really been out of the country. I've been on a couple cruises down to the Caribbean, but I mostly stay within the States. I've got friends in California and lived in Idaho for a while. And I usually I'm also a parrot head, so I go to an event each year in the Gulf Coast. So that's a lot of fun. And we have a very good friend who's also a director of Chattacon, who has been a director of Chattacon for many years, recently has relocated to New York City, so that's our next destination. I've been once many years ago, and I've heard it's changed a lot, but it's still a great city, so I'd like to get up there and visit.
That's my impression, too. Mm-hmm. It's been several decades since I've been to the city, and from talking to people, I'm not sure I recognize it.
I do love New Orleans.
Oh, me too.
New Orleans.
Yes. Yeah. Yes, so...
It's interesting that you said the way you describe the person who's over the whole convention sounds almost like somewhere between somebody directing a film and throwing a party.
Well, it is kind of a group effort, but we do have a chairman. We have a chairman and a vice chair, and each of us has a job. So we all have been or a part of this for a pretty long time. So we know our jobs and we know how to do it. But if somebody starts slacking a little bit, you know, the chairman kind of maybe gives them a call and says, hey, have you contacted this or have you done this? We really need to kind of get those tables ordered. So they make sure that things are being done in the timely fashion, and we're going to have a show. We're going to have a...
Well, it takes a huge amount of organization, together. I would think.
Right.
And yeah. how many of you are there in that core? Yeah, the board is essentially the core, right? And then you have all these volunteers that come on and help you?
There's roughly 17 of us, depending on who's going and coming and who's taking a job and who's taking two jobs. There's about 17 of us that have been the core for...
And then you guys coordinate an individual roster of volunteers? Is
yes,
that how
we
works?
Each have our own department, and each department has its own set of volunteers. Gaming has a long list of volunteers. Programming has a long list of volunteers. We have security, just making sure things are, you know, secure. We have the art show gallery people. They're the ones that are in there selling the art and hanging the art and making sure it doesn't go anywhere. We have the con suite people that are in the con suite making sure the food's all out there and the ice is stocked, and we've got Cokes and everything for everybody. Each department has its own staff. So all together we're around 200 staff and volunteers and people that are
That's a good party.
Involved.
So there's 200 people coordinating a party for 800 people.
Pretty much. And, or entertaining. I mean, that includes the guests. So
that's ideal.
And it's, you know, intimate enough where you can actually sit and... you can ride an elevator with your favorite author. You could.
I'm getting that. That's one of the things that is the buzz for you, Casey, is getting to meet these writers. Huh?
I do love to just sit and talk with them and pick their brains about things. And we'll have little workshops where the artists will draw pictures and just have them to give out. You know, it's just very intimate. You get to know somebody a little bit better than just reading a bio or watching something on the internet.
Well, doubtless. I mean, you're spending the weekend with them. It's effectively like a country house party, isn't it?
Well, you and 800 other people.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's very different than a book signing, for example.
Yeah.
When you queue up or you line up. I'm reminded I can't say queue because people don't know what I mean by that. When you line up and you stand and wait and then you're rushed to the front and you give him your book.
Maybe 2 minutes to say something and that's about
yes,
it.
Yes,
right?
And he's hurried and he's quick and he doesn't even look up at you. That was my experience of a book signing once.
So do the writers that come to the convention, that they basically hang out with you for the weekend?
Well, they have their tables. We do have signings. We do have, you know, mm-hmm. we're specific times where they're sitting at a table and they're signing books. So people will bring stacks of books. If Larry Niven's there, it's usually a stack of books people are bringing. this year, Robert McCammon, he's got a lot of 23 novels, I think, that he's got. And he wrote... starting in the 70s, but he kind of took a break in the 90s, but he's back now and he's writing this new series, so he's very popular right now. So and the other guests that are coming, and Michael, there'll be people there signing books in the dealer's room and in other places, but I don't ever sit still long enough to talk really to people, but because I'm always moving around. But yeah, the authors will come to the con suite and sit down and just chat with people, or after a panel, they'll sit and just talk with people. So, and especially in the evening when there's different room parties going on, but they're just socializing. So it's just like you get to hang out with them.
Because they're really no different. Like our Mike here, you're as much a fan as you are a creator, aren't you, Mike?
Very much so. I'm very excited by the idea of Larry Niven having been in attendance.
Oh, yeah.
He's written one of my favorite books, one of the books that I consider to be the best example of an alien culture in science fiction.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah. He wrote a book called Footfall.
It's called what?
Footfall. It's about these rather primitive aliens that somehow have supremely advanced technology. Physically primitive, I mean. They haven't, you know, evolved terribly well. And they somehow have technology that they shouldn't have been able to acquire through their evolutionary process. And there's a big question in humanity's mind. How on earth did they get so smart and so good when they're rather dumb? Frankly.
Cavemen with computers kind of thing?
Basically, yeah. And it turns out they kind of inherited it all from the predecessors on their planet. So it's like, you know, the apes inherit mankind's technology and assume it's theirs. nonetheless, they come over, they conquer the earth, and then it's mankind's struggle to regain his birthright, and successfully. Ruin it for everyone.
So, as Casey said, it's called speculative fiction.
Indeed.
And the speculation is, I guess, at the heart of all of the work that's written, is who are we and where are we going, right? The eternal question for all of us.
I tend to do a lot of that dwelling, actually, in some of my stuff. You know, that's metaphysical, baby. That's where I live.
So you said that you were surprised when you realized that there's something of you in particularly in one of the characters you created.
Yeah.
But like most writers, my guess would be that much of what you write, the reason you write it is to answer questions for yourself.
Well, I don't know about that. I haven't navel-gazed to that extent. I write because I want to express myself. Now, what's interesting is I wanted to be a writer since I was in my teens. I've always wanted to be a writer, but I never had the confidence. I literally felt I had nothing of value to say, nothing to contribute whatsoever. And then at some point in my late 40s, something snapped inside my brain, or a little switch was flipped. And suddenly I realized it was time. I must have acquired something of value or something of interest, whether it was through experiences, through travel, through reading, through a combination of all of that, I don't know. But I suddenly woke up and I had ideas, and they flooded and they came out. And I've made notations for something in the region of 25 different novels now, ranging from all sorts of crazy things like reincarnation, past life re-immersion experiences and things. So I've got a whole bunch of ideas pending, and I'm desperate to write them, but it's all about the discipline necessary, the strength of character and strength of will to carry a book to completion, and simply having the time.
Well, that's right.
That's
what
the bigger
running
challenge
through my mind. Yeah. How
yeah.
much time do you tend to spend writing every day?
Not as much time as I would like. I've got a real job now. I have to make money. Previously, when I was working in the research field, there was plenty of time for thinking whilst actually working, because that's what I was paid to do. I was paid to think. So I was used to think on my own stuff a little bit more than I should have. So nowadays, I'm a little bit more focused on actually making ends meet. But nonetheless, there's still time. And I spend a little bit of time doing a lot of editing for other people. I do some help producing people's books. I help them self-publish. I've been a publisher for 5 years or 6 years now, and I've kind of started to veer away from publishing their books to helping them self-publish, because I believe that's really the future now. So that's been a change for me. But for my own writing, it's taken a real backseat lately, and I'm waiting for a sea change. I'm waiting for not so much inspiration to hit, but for a combination or the planets to align or something to occur to enable me to suddenly say, now it's time to go back and re-immerse myself into that routine.
Well, it seems to me that in some sense, editing and writing are very much the same thing.
Well, they are when I do it. Because
it's hard to do both because they both draw on the same skills.
I can't just simply comment on spelling and grammar.
Right. You're helping people tell stories.
I'm helping them rewrite, restructure. Mm. I do what's called a line edit, I guess. I will actually help them rebuild their sentence structures and so on, and ask about the choice of words and things. And this one might have more impact, and this one has a slightly different meaning, but in this context, it could be. I really go into that level of detail because I can't not. I don't know how to do it any other way. So when I edit a book, I'm horribly brutal, but I'm also extremely supportive and creative, and the end result is always going to be superior to the original. It's going to be much better because I put as much time and effort into it as the writer has.
Right. So all of a sudden, it's not the product of one mind anymore. It's the product of two
minds.
No,
I'd like to still think it's their product. I mean, it would be awful to say that I have a hand in that. It's mine as much as his. I don't think that at all. All I think of is I've helped them, let's say, in some way, refine the words and the work.
Whether we're talking about a producer with musicians or an editor with the writers,
I think
they play an essential role.
Yeah, I agree.
You know,
I think the producer in a music setting is a similar thing entirely. Mm. I mean, George Martin, for example, scored the strings for Eleanor Rigby. The members of the band themselves, the Beatles, they wouldn't have been able to do that. He also scored, what was the great cacophony noise in that one song by John?
Day in the Life.
Yeah, he scored that too. And that was effectively just go from point A to point B in this amount of time and don't worry about anything in the middle. Just do what you like. That was...
So he was helping them realise ideas that they had in their imagination.
That's correct.
And you're doing the same thing for the writers you work with,
it seems to me. I like to think so.
And maybe with the people who come up and buttonhole you at the convention, huh?
I will absolutely help anybody that wants help if I'm able to give it to them. My thinking is that writing is not something that's solitary necessarily. I often find it takes a village. When I've written a book and it's published and it's out, there could be at least 20 or 30 people that have helped along the way in various things, from advising on, let's say, technology that the Soviets had in the 80s to a particular institute that they would have referred to. I get details from individual Russians who knew and worked in these places that I don't have. So when I go to that level of detail, I get expert help. And I'm only one of many that can help somebody. So I'm the frontline helper. I'll go in there into the trenches and help you reshape the words and maybe rethink a little bit about plot structure and things, because there could be some little tricks that you can do that might improve the flow, the pacing, and so on. But then when it comes to, like, for example, medieval armor, if you've written a historical, I don't know enough about that to know what's relevant or what's wrong or anything. But every now and again, I'll catch something. For example, I recently caught somebody writing about doorknobs in a medieval setting. There were no doorknobs in medieval times. You didn't have the mechanisms.
Just door pulls, I guess, huh?
They had latches.
Well, we're out of time, but it occurs to me again, talking to you both, that the convention began as a celebration of people's work, but becomes almost a sort of collaborator with their work just through these conversations that inevitably you have at the convention. It brings everybody together, as you said, Casey, like-minded souls, all with a passion for what everybody else is creating.
Some of the most interesting conversations you could ever want to get into about space, about aliens, about science, about dragons, and, you know, maybe there's somebody dressed up in the conversation. Maybe there's a Starfleet commander. Maybe there's a Jedi Knight. Maybe there's a Stormtrooper. But we're all really kind of the same, in the same boat. We all are part of that fantasy world, that world that we make up. And the more people that come and enjoy it and realize it's here, we've been in Chattanooga for 45 years, and there are a lot of people that still don't even know we exist. So just trying to get everyone that might think that this is interesting to come and check it out and look around, maybe get some art or purchase something in the dealer's room, buy a costume to wear next year.
Do you still have any openings? Can people still book a room?
I believe the hotel might be sold out, but since we're right here at the beginning, I think there's some people shuffling, so there might be one or two drops and one or two pickups, but we, of course, all will have memberships. They'll need to come and register at the door, but the convention starts Friday at 3 p.m. That's when the doors open for registration, and everything starts Friday afternoon.
And so it's all chattacon.org. That's where you go if you want to find out all the details, right?
At the Doubletree Inn at 4th and Chestnut.
Thanks, guys. Fun talking to you.